Hello, it's Antrese, and welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast.
This episode is sponsored by Gamblin' Artist Colors. And if you've got questions about oil colors, I'd like to invite you, yes, you, to submit your questions about colors to savvypainter.com/Gamblin'. You might remember that earlier this year, Gamblin founder Robert Gamblin and President Pete Cole came on to answer your questions. This time, Scott Gelatley, the product manager for Gamblin and a painter himself, will be joining Robert and I to answer your questions. Go to savvypainter.com/Gamblin. That's savvypainter.com/Gamblin to ask your questions before January 7th. This past November, you might remember that I teamed up with Gamblin Artist Colors and Trickell Art Supplies for our first ever art competition. Our judge was the artist Carol Marine. Carol was an early guest on this podcast, and she also runs the website Daily Paintworks. Carol selected the winning entries that were part of the online exhibition at dailybrushwork.com. Congratulations to everyone whose work was selected for the online exhibition. There was a lot of great work submitted. Honorable mention went out to Christian Fagerlund for his untitled piece, and to Hannah Mogbul for her painting Mandarin, and Brian DiNicola for his painting Midnight Hours. Congratulations to all of you. I am super excited to have not one, but three guests this week. Our first, second, and third place winners are here to share their stories. So Carol Marine chose Randall David Tipton's Cascade Head Spring for third place, and Susie Zefting Kuhn's painting I Have My Eye on You as our second place winner. You'll be hearing a bit from both of them in this episode, but first, I am delighted to present to you a conversation with our first place winner, Julie Beck. Julie Beck won first prize for her painting Red Hand, Green Thumb. Julie received $1,000 in art supplies from Trickell and Gamblin, some cold hard cash, and a full interview here with me on the Savvy Painter Podcast. Julie Beck was born and raised in upstate New York. She now lives in Boston, Massachusetts, where she teaches painting at the Academy of Realist Art. And in this episode, we talk about taking risks, how finding the right tribe changed everything, and Julie gives me a great tip on signing paintings. And I have to admit, I was pretty excited about her hack. Signing paintings is not my favorite thing. So without further ado, here is Julie Beck. Julie, welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast, and congratulations on winning first prize in the art competition. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you. I'm over the moon about this, and I'm really excited. I listen to this podcast a lot, and like I feel like I know you already, and I just really have enjoyed listening to all the artists and feeling like I'm a part of a community that experiences a lot of the same things that I've experienced. So I'm glad I could be a part of it, and hopefully, you know, other people feel like they can relate to me in the same way.
I bet they will. Tell me the story about that painting you entered into the competition. It's Red Hand, Green Thumb, correct?
Yes. That painting was a total accident, and it didn't happen on purpose in a way. I work from both life and photos, and I had taken a whole bunch of photo shoots of a student and friend named John, and I ended up with two pictures. One of them ended up going into Are We Men or Are We Comets, which is the painting it was intended for. But I had kind of a one-off that I thought was really interesting. So I kind of kept it off to the side. And then I ended up going on an artist retreat where a bunch of artists get together, and they kind of, artists are always busy and they don't want to just take a week off to hang out with each other. So they did, this group of artists got together to all work in the same room together. So they rented out kind of a cabin and everybody stayed for the week, but we all worked in the same big room together. And I wanted to bring something totally different from how I normally work. And so I decided I'd take this one-off picture that I thought was really interesting compositionally and just the expression. And I decided just to go to town. It was a complete departure from my normal process. I work at and I teach at, and I normally work in a very controlled process. Everything is planned. And by the time I get to painting, I'm ready to go. I usually finish like 95% of the paintings I start because so much work goes into it before any paint goes onto the canvas. Mm-hmm. So I brought a completely blank canvas, and that is super scary. So I brought this reference image, and I brought a blank white canvas, and I had no plan. So
I love it.
It was frightening.
That's the best part, Julie.
There's like zero control over the situation. So it was a really scary process. And I'm working alongside some of the most incredible artists. I was invited along this retreat with, like, I don't know if you know who Julie Bell is and Boris Vallejo.
Oh, wow.
I mean, these people are amazing. And this is the first time I was invited. And I was like, I don't want to look like an amateur. I want to be like a professional. But at the same time, I want to get outside my comfort zone. So that painting, I started straight onto the canvas with paint, totally unlike me. I had no plan for the background. I had no plan for an environment. And I just started going for it. And it was really scary. But, you know, like so many people on your podcast have said, like getting outside your comfort zone and doing something that is scary is a huge opportunity to grow and discover new processes or just seeing something new and discovering more about yourself in the process. So that painting is very interesting for me because it's such a departure from the process, but I think I learned so much from it and it allowed me to be a little bit more daring mm-hmm. and risky. And I have to say, and it sounds so ridiculous when you see this painting, every single one of those bold brushstrokes was like torture.
Really? You mean like in the background?
Yeah. Total.
Why?
Torture.
Oh my God, they look so free. Tell me why? What happened?
They are the most unfree thing for me because there's no right or wrong. There's, you just.
You need a math problem for this?
Yes. There's no like rules. And that's very uncomfortable for
me. Oh, I love it.
And it was funny because I'd have students in and out and I'd literally be like, and I just put it down. So it's comical, but seriously, the hardest part of that whole painting was each individual, because I like purpose to things. Everything kind of usually has a reason. And
yeah,
that was very uncomfortable. So
that is so funny. So did you kind of set your mind to the brush will only hit the canvas once on those brush strokes, or was it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. A couple times I would go back and say, you know what? That just looks too contrived, I guess. I wanted it to look like it didn't take effort.
And yet it's the part that took the most effort.
Oh, totally. It's just my personality though.
That is hilarious.
I gotta learn to loosen up. I know that.
I love it. It's so funny. Where did you get the title? Tell me about the title.
Okay. So Red Hand, Green Thumb, the original painting that I was doing the portrait of is more of a concept of kind of general humanity and how we interact with each other and how one person can come into your life and totally like sideline you or say something. And I remember somebody else in one of your podcasts was saying how somebody came by and mentioned that something looked messy. And for like the next 20 years, every time she'd do something,
that was me.
Yeah. So it's like one person.
Offhanded remark.
Totally. So that was the original concept for the photo shoot. But then this one-off, I did it more as kind of a portrait of this person who's become very close to me and we're like really good friends. And I don't do a lot of portraits. If you look through a lot of my portfolios, it's mostly still life and some animals and, you know, a portrait here and there. So this was kind of an experiment to do more of a portrait of a person. And so Red Hand, Green Thumb is the concept of like kind of being caught red-handed, mm-hmm. where John tends to be a person who wears his heart on his sleeve. And he puts himself out there. He's very outgoing. But at the same time, he can be reserved in some ways. And he doesn't share his whole self, you know, which I think we all do. We all have parts of ourselves that we don't show people. So he's kind of exposed. And his expression has this very like open vulnerability to it. But at the same time, Green Thumb is somebody who helps other people grow and brings things out of other people. So I think he's also a person who does that, where he's our official social ambassador at our school. So he tends to get people to open up. So I think he's, you know, somebody who helps other people grow and see parts of themselves that they didn't realize. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's also somebody who has parts of himself that he's also trying to, you know, our internal selves, our external selves, who we are to different people, and trying to consolidate those, I guess. Mm. So that's where the title comes from. That's a concept of it. And it was more meant to be like a portrait of a person that maybe other people can relate to. You know, there's like an ambiguity to it. So he's both confident and outgoing, but mm-hmm. also kind of vulnerable and insecure in some ways.
Nice.
I go so artsy fartsy into some of this stuff.
I love it. It's great. I mean, that's why I wanted to ask about the title, because I could tell. I just knew. And I'm always afraid, like, I don't know why, even though, like, Green Thumb, how could you mess that up? But I'm always afraid I'm going to say, it's the green hand, red thumb. Oh, no, wait. That's why I was kind of like, it's red hand, green thumb. Did I say it right?
Yeah, and titles for me, actually, I love titling paintings. It's one of my favorite parts of creating something.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I hate it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. I actually have a list of orphan titles. So I'll come across like a phrase or something that's really intriguing to me. Or if I'm reading a book and there's like a little line that catches me, I have a whole list of title. Like, this would be a great title for a painting. People do that with band names. Like, oh, that'd be a good band name title.
Yeah.
So I do that with titles for paintings, and I keep like a list of like 100 orphan titles.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny. I was just, maybe that's what I need to do. And that would just spark it and just get my juices, you know, the juices flowing, because I was interviewing another artist and she pulls phrases. She's a big reader. She pulls phrases from books.
Yep. Books, songs, poetry, philosophy. I mean, anything, or just something that somebody says, just a phrase that kind of catches my ear. And I've used it both ways, where it's a seed for an idea, where that'll kind of kick off an idea or a concept where I'm going to start maybe researching or pulling together images. And I've had other times where I have a painting that I don't really have a narrative to, or it's just a still life. I really enjoyed these kind of colors and compositions together. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you read through the list, one of them just punches me right in the face. Mm. Whoa, that's totally the title. And then it adds on a whole layer of narrative, a layer of meaning that maybe I didn't realize until I made that connection. I've had a couple of paintings where by titling it made it a completely different experience for me.
I get that completely. That's so interesting, because I used to do a lot of figurative work, and for some reason it was so much easier for me to name paintings when it was figurative work.
Ooh, interesting.
I know. I'm kind of real. As I was listening to it, I was like, realizing what was going on, I'm like, whoa, this is getting weird. But titles often came out of just a snippet of the music that I was listening to, and it would mm-hmm. and it would do the same thing. Like, I wouldn't really get the painting, or, you know, I'd be kind of struggling with it, and then all of a sudden I would get the title and then everything clicked, and it was a feeling, you know. Most of the time it was just more about the feeling that I got from the music than the actual words, I think. It's so interesting.
It is. And I also think that with titles, I don't sketch. I'm like a horrible artist. I don't sketch. I can't draw out of my head. I don't have this like well of creative ideas that to be made into paintings that are like visuals floating around my head. Mm-hmm. I literally start with just words and concepts. And I think actually one of the most recent podcasts you had, she said the same thing. They start with words.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was, and I totally can relate to that. I feel like you could just kind of piece together the last like 20 interviews and you'd have this interview, but
it wouldn't be the same, Julie. It would not be the same.
I hope not. Yeah. So it starts with a word or a concept. And then I pull together maybe reference images, or I pull together some ideas, where I don't start things visually. I start things with words. And I think that orphan titles help in terms of the jumping off point. But it also helps to piece everything together at the end. So sometimes they're needed in different endpoints of the idea or the concept that I'm going to be working on. Mm-hmm. But to me, like, titling is so much fun. I love it.
That's great. You just made something click for me. So that's really interesting. I'm kind of curious if I'm going to be as belligerent as I am about. I'm like, oh, God. Like the two things I personally just hate are the titles and signing my name. Like I hate signing my name so much. It's like
rubber stamp it. That's my thing.
Really? I've tried that before and it didn't like I couldn't get it to work. How do you make it work?
Oh, I hate. I have the same hatred of signing paintings. It takes me like a year.
Yeah, it's like my mom yanked me out of something really fun and is making me do my homework. I'm just like, I'm pissed. I hate it. I'm like, really? Do they need my signature on this? I mean, come on.
Well, I think part of it was I'd never had anything consistent. And then when I did do it, it always looked so weird and it was never, I hated it. So yeah. I was like, screw this. I'm making a rubber stamp. So I actually used to be a graphic designer. I spent 10 years doing graphic design and editing and stuff like that. But something that I feel that I got out of a lot of that was being kind of graphically proficient. And so I said, I'm going to create this in Illustrator. I'm going to make a rubber stamp out of it. It's kind of just like it's a shapey thing. There's a lot of, it's related to squares. Mm-hmm. And I just want this little simple, my last name is four letters. It's really easy. And I just use a rubber stamp. And sometimes I have to clean it up a little bit, but it's so much easier. Rubber stamp it.
Okay, I'm going to try it.
Or sign it on the back. You don't have to sign it.
I know. It's so funny. My response to it is completely irrational, and I know that, but I'm still like,
It's frustrating. Because you feel like, oh, it's like that wonderful, you tie it up with a bow and you sign it, and then you spend like 4 hours trying to get this thing to look halfway decent,
right.
And then it's too big, and then it's too loud, and then it looks like a mess.
Yeah, exactly. So do you have different stamps for different sizes?
No, what I do is I have the one size stamp for anything that's 11 by 14 and up. Uh-huh. And then everything smaller than that, I have to thank Carol Marine actually for giving me the confidence to start using flats early on. Because I was told, especially with my more classical training, is that people tend to use filberts. And then it's because everything I do is related to squares, my last name, it's just kind of a bunch of straight lines. I said, I'm just using the flat. I just use a very small flat and I just create the boxes and it's just little kind of hash marks pieced together. Oh, it's very easy. I just use a size 2 flat. It's fabulous. It's just square, square.
Done.
Square. Okay. Done. And I like to hide it. I don't like it to be super obvious. I'll make it look like it's carved into the wood or just make it quiet. I don't like it to be loud.
Right, right. The bright red on the, on the only red in the whole painting is your signature.
Yeah. Like, no, that's all I'm going to be staring at.
Sorry, I didn't mean to like spend 20 minutes talking about your signature. That's pretty funny.
It's who I am.
That's right. But these are the things though. Like, I'm sure we're going to get like a bunch of people who are like, oh my God, stamps. Yes.
Yes. It's like rubberstamps.com or something. It's something so... I have this obsession with trying to find the most efficient way of doing things.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually a very lazy painter.
The most efficient people are the laziest. I am so late. Like, I will not do the same thing twice. It just irritates me. So I find a system, a process, whatever. So lazy.
Oh, yeah. And with oil painting, I feel like there's so much you can do to make the paint work for you. And that's partially what I love about oil painting is you have so much ability to make the paint work for you rather than to have to do all the work. And so, you know, something like finding the most efficient way to do wood grain or finding the most efficient way to just have an awesome thing at the end, but not have to do
all that work.
Do all the work to get there. So I'm lazy, but I still want a good thing at the end. So the stamp's kind of my compromise of signing it, looks good, professional, cha-ching, send it out the door.
Right, right. I'm stealing that. I'm totally doing it. Like I did, like I told you, I tried it and I just couldn't get, but I think it was because you're going to laugh at this. I tried to carve my own and it was just awesome. Yeah. And I was like, do I do this backwards? Like how do, forget it.
Order it online, make your life easy.
Did I say I was efficient? That's not me. I was going to ask you something before this and then I got just completely derailed by the fact that you use stamps. I'm like, oh my God, she does it. Somebody does it and they do it well.
Yeah. I'm lazy.
Actually, can you elaborate on your laziness and like what are some of the ways that you make the oil paint work for you?
Like I said, I'm super lazy, but I'm not afraid of hard work. Let's get that straight. I'm lazy, but I'm not afraid of hard work. So typically the way I was trained was the French academic method. And, you know, our base process is kind of an indirect painting where you're doing a bunch of different layers and working from large to small, general to specific, and really being methodical about it. And so as I've kind of taken my training and then tried to like go where I want to with it, I'm starting to really figure out the most efficient way of doing things. So if I'm painting old wood, I like to paint a lot of stuff with character and imperfections. And I like the kind of natural organicness of stuff that's been used or lived with or been a part of experience. And so those things are, if you paint them in that very specific way of indirect painting, you tend to kind of get a perfection or an idealist execution of something. And so when I try to use the paint to work for me, I think about the paint's transparency. I think about what I'm actually looking at and why it looks that way. So maybe I'm looking at old chipped wood with some paint flaking off. And I'm actually going to be thinking about the process of, okay, so maybe I want to layer the wood color underneath as an imprimatur, is that first pass of paint. Then I'm going to actually physically put the paint on a little bit thicker, like I was actually painting some wood, but leave some pieces showing through rather than me having to repaint the whole area. And then using actually just kind of either bristle brushes or palette knives to get this kind of scratchy look on top. So I'm layering with purpose and I'm layering knowing what the paint's going to do. And that just comes from like making a ton of paintings and having experience about what paints are more transparent. If I add more oil, it's going to be more transparent. If I use a specific brush, shout out to Trickell's hog bristles. Love those. the hog bristles are great for different textures and using fur and all this type of stuff. So I think about what I'm painting and why I'm seeing it the way it is. And then I try to use my paint on purpose, using the nature of the paints and also just layering it in a certain way so that when the light goes through the paint and reflects back to us, you're kind of experience what you would if it was an actual experience in life.
Nice.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'm curious. Okay, so I want to ask, You can see when my brain starts to short circuit, there's like five questions just fighting to get to my mouth first. They're like, me first. Okay, so first question is, do you sort of plan that out ahead of time? So when you're looking at, you set up a still life and you're looking at it, are you kind of like, as you're sitting there staring at it, are you kind of thinking like, okay, how am I going to do that piece of it? I bet if I use this layering technique and that brush, that would probably do it. Or are you just kind of going for it and figuring it out as you go along?
Both. It depends if I've painted that thing before. So usually if it's something similar to what I've painted before, I'll have a general idea of how I'm going to approach it. So for example, I'm doing something with skunk fur in it right now. And I've done a ton of white rabbit fur and it's lovely when it's done well. But when I first started doing it, it looked like total garbage. So that was when I started painting fur, I had to do a bunch of trial and errors where that didn't look right. That looks too blotchy, you know. So that was some trial and error. But then once I understood that if I paint the colors under the fur first and then layer the fur color on top, it would actually work because you're seeing through the fur. So when I started doing my skunk fur, which is totally different color, different values and everything, I still came at it with a similar process thinking, all right, well, underneath there's more of a warm reddish color and then I can layer the black fur on top and see if that gives me the kind of vibration I'm looking for. So if I'm doing it for the first time, it's usually going to be a trial and error thing. And I really truly believe that in order to be a great painter, I think you have to be comfortable being wrong. And it's okay to be wrong because that means you figured out what's not working. And then you can move on to something else that might actually work. So getting comfortable just knowing what your paints are going to do. It's kind of purposeful experimentation, doing things on purpose because, hey, I know this has transparency, so maybe I'll try this instead. Or maybe this other paint is higher chroma, but still transparent, so maybe that would work better. So you're being experimental, but with some knowledge. That really helps. But if I painted it before, I usually have an idea of, if I use this and that and the other thing, it'll probably work itself out. Or it's going to be, I'm going to be in the general area where I want to be.
Got it. And then since you've mentioned a couple of, you've kind of thrown a few things out there that I want to talk about because I just know people are going to want to, like, I know there's a lot of people who want to hear about this.
Okay.
Tell me, so you mentioned Carol Maureen gave you that great advice about the flat brushes, and I agree. I love flat brushes.
Oh, they're my favorite. Shout out to the flat brushes.
Tell me about what the different types of brushes that you use and why, meaning when do you choose a flat over a filbert, over a sable, over, you know, squirrel hair or whatever? Because it sounds like the most obvious question in the world, but I know there's a lot of people wondering about that.
It's actually not the most obvious question in the world because it's always an evolving situation. Brushes are, I have a problem with brushes. I have so many brushes. And now with the whole Tricel gift card, I have like a lifetime supply of brushes, which I'm very happy about.
It's like a girl getting like a closet full of shoes or something like that. Like when you get that, you're just like, oh my God.
I have brushes for life. Yeah. So I don't think it's that obvious because unless you have a ton of experience with all these brushes, you don't really know. So I typically use two types of brushes. That's a lie, three. One is like a softer synthetic brush. And I'm actually currently in love with the, I think it's the Spectrum line of Tricel's brushes that I'm trying out right now. Mm-hmm. They're very soft and they're very nice. And I mostly just use flats. And that's because I'm consistently obsessed with the drawing of things. I want to make sure my drawing is accurate as I paint. And so to me, flats are a really great way to, you can do lines with them. You can use them in a certain way to get a different width. You can use them flatly. And I just find they're great to get into corners and just really be at, like, I want to be really accurate about my drawing stuff. So to me, flats are my go-to for any soft brush. And soft brushes are really going to apply a more opaque, flat application of paint. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're using a bristle, it tends to be more of like a scratchy, more aggressive application. And so what's nice about that is you can really use the transparency and that it's putting down like broken paint in a way. And it's great for fur. It's great for old wood grain. Bristles just tend to be more when I'm working in textured or older surfaces or where something I don't want just one flat, even application. And for those, I actually typically use a filbert bristle. And that'll just allow me to, again, make the paint work for me. And it's great for alla prima when I'm putting more volume of paint down. But for typical, usually once I'm past the first couple passes or I'm doing some really fine detail work, synthetics and softs, I don't do sables because I usually can't afford them. So I destroy brushes. I don't know what I do. I know people who are like, I've been using the same paintbrushes for 20 years. I can't keep them for more than like a month.
Right. Mine usually end up like, what's the name of that Muppet character? Like the guy with the red hair.
Oh, it's the guy who played the drums. Yeah, totally.
That's what my brushes look like pretty quickly.
That's okay, though, because those are great for other uses. So don't ever throw out your old cruddy brushes because you can use those for just general washes or just, you know, actually painting fur. Sometimes those work really nicely. So I still have like most of my brushes, but it doesn't mean they're still good for using for detail work.
Right.
But yeah, so synthetic smaller flats are what I typically use for fine detail work. Larger flats for flat applications or if I'm doing big gradient backgrounds. But for the most part, bristles are great for just starting first pass stuff or really getting texture, fur, and that type of stuff. So I'm all for get a bunch of stuff and try it and just use it until you know exactly what it's going to do. And it's the same with paints. Like just get a set of paints. Don't have to get all the fancy colors. Just get a basic standard palette and just use the heck out of it until you know exactly what it's going to do in any situation.
Nice. Nice. I love it. You mentioned that you're teaching in Boston and you guys have just acquired some new space, but more importantly, you've got a nice big open space now. I mean, we're very happy for the school.
Yes. So my school, which I do have to give a plug to, is the Academy of Realist Art in Boston. And it completely changed my life. The minute I set foot in there, I drank the Kool-Aid and I was in and I love it. And it basically gave me the freedom to make the work that I want to make. Because before that, I didn't know that you could actually be taught this stuff. I just kind of assumed you either had it and you just knew how to paint. All my experience had been self-taught. I didn't know ateliers existed. And I'd taken a bunch of classes at some CE places and just was so disappointed because nobody was teaching me how to make this really highly technical work. Mm-hmm. So when I first came to ARA Boston and I walked in, it was like, they could tell me to shine their shoes and I would do it. If I can paint like that, whatever they tell me to do to learn how to paint like this, I will do that. So it became a second home to me. They're my family. They're my friends. They're the people who I spend the most time around, other than my husband, obviously, but I'm sure if he could be there, then I'd be there 24 hours a day. But it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And we're all so passionate. And so I've been teaching there and I've been the assistant director there. And the most wonderful thing has happened, which is, yes, we did get an additional floor, which is great because it means we can have more students. But it also means I actually have my very first studio room to myself.
So exciting.
I can actually like spread my arms and my studio space is wider than that.
So do you ever just like go in there and just spread your arms and start twirling around? And
I'm not joking. I have done that like once a week since I've gotten it. I can have two still lifes going at once.
Oh my it's God. Luxury. Wow. Because I'm in a loft in my home, which is very small, and it's my recording studio and my painting studio. So you can imagine.
But small spaces are underrated because it does force you to be very organized. Mm-hmm. I love pegboards for organizing, and I'm very efficient with the space. So even with a larger space, I'm still obsessed with trying to have the most efficient set up an organization. So my drying racks are up on a shelf and I've got an old dentist cabinet holding all my still life stuff so I can just open them and see what I have and play around and, but it can all be put away and open clean floor.
Love it. So yeah. How long have you had this space and what has it, I can just read into what it means to have two still lives going at the same time. I'm a little bit jealous, but what, not that I don't love my own studio, but how has this changed or has it your painting?
It's actually less about the space and more about being at the school more. So I'm sure either you or other people can relate to this, but every single time that I go to the easel, every time, I'm not exaggerating, it scares me and I feel uncomfortable. And I think this is going to be the day that I realize that I can't paint, or
the painting police are going to drop down through the roof and rappelling down and be like, Julie, drop that brush.
Who do you think you are?
We're taking all of this.
Yeah, every single time. And that's scary. Mm-hmm. And it's uncomfortable. And I know it's going to be like that for at least the first hour I'm painting. Mm-hmm. But when I would paint at my home studio, it was very easy to give in and to the insecurities and distract myself. And I found that when I painted at the school, that didn't happen. And that was because I felt an obligation to both my students and the other instructors who are working. And I was surrounded by people who were passionate and interested in what I was doing. And so I feel a sense of responsibility, but also, you know, they're there working. I need to be there working. And it made it easier for me just to tell those voices in my head that say, do you really know what you're doing? Is this a stupid idea? And it's very easy when you're surrounded by people who are passionate and rooting for you.
Yeah.
To quiet those and just get to the easel and just put some paint down. And so that, you know, something for me was realizing I am much more productive. I am much happier when I'm making, and it's easier to do that when I'm surrounded by the other instructors and students at the school. So that was really important for me.
I love it. That's so great. And it's so true. It's so weird. Like I see people doing this so often. I do it myself. It's like, if we don't make it hard, or if it's not hard, it's like, it's not valuable or worthwhile or something. Like, we're automatically suspicious when we enjoy it and we're having fun. And, you know, like, there's this bizarre Puritan, I don't know what it is, thing I see in a lot of us, that it's kind of like, well, if I'm not suffering for my art, then something's wrong. It must not be serious, or I don't know. Like, it's got to, we make it, it's like we have to make it so difficult, and it's really not.
Yeah. I mean, it is difficult in some ways. It's difficult in a different way than I think most people realize. And I think it's partially because we do come to it. We come from a very raw place. We're putting ourselves out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of your constantly exposed type of hardness.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I have to say, like, even the hardest day doing what we're doing is better than like the best day when I wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes I think like I didn't have a tortured enough childhood to be an artist. I just think, you know, there's other ways I torture myself, like trying to paint fur and.
Well, yeah, I mean, the skill is difficult, but I think we multiply that difficulty by like 50 when we start playing these mind games with ourselves, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I know it's so weird that we choose to torture ourselves like that. Just get in there, paint. It'll be like, you know, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
I tell my students that every time, just keep painting. Like, it's going to be fine. Like, you screw up, so what? You're going to do another layer. No big deal. And I can't even say that to myself sometimes.
I know. I know. And that's why I think we so desperately need communities, and why that, you know, that school and the community that it provides for you is so important, because you need me to tell you, stop worrying about it. You're going to be okay. It's all in your head. Just focus on the painting. Mm-hmm. And I need you to tell me exactly the same thing like 30 seconds later.
Absolutely. I mean, it's true. And there is community. I have to say, if anybody's feeling demotivated or feeling like they just need to, you know, they need somebody, just surround yourself with other creatives. It doesn't have to be an artist. With poets, just people who are creative, just surround yourself with people who are making.
Mm.
And I guarantee that it's going to help. It's going to help, because you're going to be caught up in the river of people making, and then you're going to get swept up into it. And it's just surround, it's community is such a huge, huge part. And that was the biggest takeaway from one of the biggest takeaways. I took the illustration masterclass about 3 years ago for the first time. And it was amazing. And it was life-changing. And one of the biggest things that was a takeaway was, for a week, I was surrounded by these people who were, I didn't even know these people. And they were so passionate. And you leave 7 days later feeling like you have like 100 new best friends. And you go home and you're like, I'm going to make stuff, and I'm going to be brave, and we're going to make amazing stuff, and we stay connected. It's the community really becomes this river that you can get swept up into. So if anybody's feeling demotivated or uninspired, just surround yourself with other creative people, or just makers, or people who are inspiring to you.
Great advice. I keep wanting to just like create this almost like a hippie. I'm laughing at myself. I can't even say it without laughing, but because it would be so awesome, but it's also just saying it's so funny to me, like this total kind of artist hippie commune or whatever. Yeah. Just like a place where people can come create
my God.
Feed off of each other. I want like 50 acres of land.
Yeah.
So we can have like a central location where everybody can come together and just, you know, pound on the drums or pound on the canvas or whatever it is you need to do. But there's lots of space so that if you're, you know, you, because I will need to be away from people, there's plenty of spaces you can go where nobody will find you. You can just go be your introverted self.
Yeah. So, Antrese, we are already trying to plan that.
Oh, really?
It's more of the dream utopia that we, at school, we talk about this. I'm like, I just want to buy a big castle and any artist can come and there's going to be a big common creating room.
Yes.
And we're all gonna, like, it's going to be like dorms, but you can have your own room.
Yes.
And I'm going to live on the top floor and then you're going to have a studio in the basement. It's I'm in. If you want to do it, I'm in.
Oh my God. This is turning into something different than the normal podcast. It's like, but
I'm
it's
in.
Funny. So my husband and I would sit there and talk, like, so I did that Portrait of Argentina thing. So we would spend like days in the car driving. And when we're driving, we come up with these crazy ideas. So in Argentina, people have, it's, they have asados all the time. So you have, and an asado is basically, he gets really upset when I compare it to a barbecue because it is something special and unique, but you're cooking food outside and everybody comes over.
It's a barbecue.
It's a barbecue. So, but it's such a huge part of their culture that homes have a special, it's called a quincho, and it's a special area for the asados. And what it's for is like, you have these asados so often that you don't always want people coming in and out of your house. So you kind of have like this separate, it's almost like a big giant garage where there's a grill and there's a bathroom and a shower, like, you know, like everything you would need. You just don't have to like come in and out of the house. You can set up giant tables or whatever. So we had this whole, and he even drew it out because my husband's in construction. So completely sustainable, off the grid.
Oh, perfect.
And then you would have like this central like quincho area where people can come together, like basically a gigantic kitchen.
Yeah.
Where people can come cook, eat together, whatever. But then you have like a circle of cabins or whatever along the perimeter, which are basically your own painting studio and your own little kitchen. Cause you know, sometimes we don't always want to eat with everybody else. Can you tell, like, I'm really sensitive about the introverts. Like, you need to be able to go away if you need to.
I need my personal time.
Right. You get your personal time. You don't always have to eat with everybody. You can if you want. It's all in the open. But you have all that and you have your own working space, or there's like tons of areas where you can, you know, like a big room where people can work together, work on joint projects, still lives, whatever. And then just constantly be inviting like all these different types of writers and painters and hire musicians to come in and play, like, you know, or just sort of like coordinate it. So like 3 months out of the year, it's all musicians. And then another 3 months, it's all artists. And then it becomes a writing commune. And then no matter what, there's always somebody gets a scholarship to go stay there for a full year. Some, you know, whatever, really talented kid that just has no other way that they could ever have this gets to go free of charge for a full year.
I'm in.
That's it.
Where are we building this?
Well, we were thinking Argentina because the land, because you can get, you know, relatively cheap land there. And, you know, we have all the connections. However, there's lots of open spaces in the US as well. So
how about Western Mass?
You know, I, even despite the fact that I have a lot of family in Massachusetts, I don't know it that well. So we would have to go on a road trip and explore it.
Totally. I'm in.
Like my answer, I'm like, I don't know, road trip.
Yeah. No, I'm totally on board with stuff like that. It's, I just find community becomes, it's not only the thing that can get you started, but then it kind of sustains.
Yeah.
It sustains you as a person, and it also helps feed your creativity. And all of a sudden you might be exposed to something that you didn't know was a possibility. Or, you know, you get inspired by somebody else's style or music or something like that. It just becomes this collective of ideas and passion and creativity just kind of swirling around in a big soup.
Exactly. And I love this concept of having not just painters, but other creative people.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that I would definitely also recommend is there's this book called Free Play. Have you read it?
I have not heard of this book.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Tell me more.
It's called Free Play, and it's called The Improvisation in Life and Art. And there's two big takeaways that I had from that book. It's literally my Bible. Like, I make all my students try to read it. What I love about it is it speaks to any art. It's written by a musician. I think he's an improvisational trumpet player or something. He's an improvisational musician. But one of the things that he recommends when you're, I don't have a big quote unquote creative well. I don't have a ton of visual ideas that I'm ready to just make and make all these lovely ideas. And so one recommendation or one process is filling your creative well with consuming other people's creativity. So, that got me going out to open mic poetry nights just to be a listener. Or going out and seeing what other people are making for visual art, or just consuming other people's outputs
mm-hmm.
is really inspiring because they're putting out what moves them. And as a human collective, we share a lot of things that move us. There's, common experiences, our human existence, we're all really experiencing the same thing. And when somebody's putting an output, there's so much there that you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And can trigger some ideas or some just a feeling that maybe you want to go on or a concept you want to explore. So I found that consuming other people's creativity and their outputs is really helpful for me in terms of getting inspiration.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so that book I totally recommend. And the other one was The Power of Limitations. So like I said, and I said previously, a blank canvas is super scary to me. So something that makes it a little bit more comfortable is starting with a limitation. And for me, that, red hand, green thumb, the limitation was here's the image I have to work from and I have nothing else. Another limitation would be, either starting from one of my orphan titles or I want to work in a limited value range. How can I challenge myself or what can I work on
mm-hmm.
in that range? So, limitations, I think, can also be a way to actually spark creativity. So that book, Free Play. The guy, I can't pronounce the guy's last name, but he's like a Russian guy.
Yeah. Is it the guy who wrote Flow? It's Chim. I can't say it without looking at it. And I have to like look at the name and then look away and then I can say it. It's kind of like, are you familiar with the book Flow? Is that who you're thinking of?
No, I'm not familiar with that book. I think he's just a musician who wrote this book about creativity and improvisation.
I will find that book.
It's wonderful and I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And I basically carry it around with me at all times.
Wow. Okay. Well, I have a 14-hour plane ride coming up next week, so I know what I'm bringing with me.
And you can finish it in the plane ride. It's a relatively short book, easy read, but I think a lot of it is going to hit a lot of really familiar chords and kind of make you see things a little from a different perspective, but also just, it's just really inspiring. For somebody who I don't think I'm naturally like a super, super creative person, it gives me new places to look and new places to find ideas or to find, things that really push my buttons.
Interesting. I'm surprised that you don't see yourself as a kind of naturally creative person or a creative person.
I would say I'm a creative person in that I'm really good at, I'm like a MacGyver. I'm the Lady MacGyver.
That is now the title of the podcast. This episode, I'm talking with Lady MacGyver.
It's true. I'm really good at taking existing things and making them into new purposes or combining things that already exist. I actually went to school for construction engineering and math. And so I like when things work in a really efficient way, or taking existing things and making it work for me,
mm-hmm.
which I think that is kind of the basis of creativity. But in terms of like, I guess, hippy dippy kind of creative artsy ideas, I don't know if that's my natural tendencies. But I feel like sometimes like when I was reading that book, it helped me find some of that undercurrent to some of the stuff that interests me.
Uh-huh.
And what pushes those buttons and why. And it allows me to kind of explore, for example, it sounds really strange, but I have this like obsession with old wooden boxes and little cubbies and everything with like a bunch of little drawers. It's very strange. But,
you know, you have this painting with a little wooden fox, I believe. And I can absolutely get that out of that painting. I keep staring at that painting. What's that one called? Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah. They That Sow the Wind? Does it has the fox and the little pig?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was actually the one painting I almost didn't sell. I ended up selling it. But that painting was both personal, but also a technical achievement for me. And it was very hard to let go of. But yeah, so like that kind of very cozy, intimate space.
Mm-hmm.
And like this, everything's kind of in its place type of feeling.
Mm.
I like compartmentalizing and organizing, but when I think creatively about it, or if I kind of think on a deeper level about it, you know, part of it is that I like the cozy spaces, and I like being intimate with other people in terms of a level of friendship, and the way I interact with the world is really reflected by these tight, close, warm spaces. And that composition, I think, really speaks to close relationships in a cozy space and warm and inviting lines swirling everywhere. So I kind of take this element that I'm interested in, and it allows me to kind of explore it further and see what the kind of hippy dippy artsy idea behind it really is.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's kind of a roundabout way of saying that, but I don't even know if I answered the question.
I love it. No, that was interesting. Actually, what's really funny is right now I'm like, what was my question? I don't know. I was just completely into what you were saying.
I'm sorry. I know. I tend to go off on these tangents. I do this at workshops too. I'll start with a very controlled way of teaching something. And then I'm like, and then here's how to do an extended grisaille. And then we're adding color. Oh, wait, we're going. That's way off into a weird.
We're coming back in.
Let's get back to what we're talking about.
I do the same thing. Don't worry. As you probably know. So that is the painting that you didn't want to sell.
Yes.
Is there one that you won't sell?
No. And actually, that's a good question, because it was going to be that painting that I didn't sell. And I asked my husband, I said, okay, so I have a technical achievement in it, and I think it's like a really personal piece. And, you know, maybe I'm just not going to sell it. I'm not going to put it in. I had a show at Bowersock Gallery, and I was like, maybe I just won't give it to him. And he said, why? And I didn't have a really great reason. Because, so my husband really expressed what I think was really important, and it kind of regrounded me. He said, you make the work to put it out into the world. So that's what you should be doing. And he was right. And he was absolutely right. And it ended up being the piece that it sold before the show opened. And I was so thankful to be able to meet the person. He came to the opening, and I got to meet the person who bought it, which was so wonderful, because he's a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's going to cherish it. We talked about it, and he was really excited about it. And he's an artist, and it just meant so much to me. I mean, when somebody brings something like that into their life and they really love it, it's like a really beautiful thing to be able to meet that person. And, you know, you just actually had this conversation with somebody else, but it's so nice to be able to have a relationship, or just even know the person that's taking this piece into their home and bringing it into their life, and that I can have some type of connection with them. And that was an important piece for me. And so that makes it even more special.
If you could own a piece of art by any living artist, what would it be, or whose?
That's a hard one, because there's so many, which I'm sure that's what everybody says. I would have to say at the moment, the person I would say is Will Wilson. Do you know who that is?
I do not.
Will Wilson is amazing. He's so unbelievably prolific. I don't know, like, he's just made so many paintings, and he's done still life and portrait and figure, and they're all horribly amazing.
I hate people like that.
And he's actually a really nice person, so it makes it even worse.
Ugh.
So for still life, I'd say for still life and for portrait, Will Wilson is really somebody I really admire. Matthew Vober is actually, I think, maybe a slightly lesser known still life artist, but his compositions and his colors are just floor me.
How do you spell his last name?
Vober, Vober. So I'd say those two. And then if I have to say, I'd like to say for animals, Julie Bell, obviously, is just unmatched. And then there's an artist named Craig Kosak. I think it's K-O-S-A-K, who I've been following since, actually, I've been following like Carol Marine since I started painting. But Craig Kosak is somebody, in terms of animals and color, that I've been just enamored with for a long time. So any one of those four, if somebody wants to ship one of those paintings to me, I'm totally fine with that.
Won't reject it.
Nope, won't send it back.
So last question, is there a habit that you have that you feel like has really helped you either in life or in your painting?
The one thing I'd say has helped me the most is to take myself seriously. When I first decided that I was going to be an artist, like for real, I made a folder on my computer and I titled it, I am an artist. And every time I made something or I took a picture of a painting I did or I made a spreadsheet for something, it went into that folder and I had to look at that and remind myself, I'm an artist and this is what I'm doing. And so by taking myself seriously, you know, all the income I make through any type of art, I report that. I take it seriously. Like, this is my job. And I think by doing that, it also forces me to treat it like a job in a way where this is my responsibility. I have a responsibility to make the work I want to make, to put it out there, and to stay organized and on top of everything. So I think just taking myself seriously, staying organized, and not being afraid to basically put myself out there as a professional with presenting myself in a professional way, taking myself seriously as an artist.
Nice. Julie, it has been so much fun to get to know you. It was a great conversation. Thank you.
This has been amazing. And I hope that people enjoy listening to it and that somebody maybe felt like they can relate to some of this. And I totally encourage anybody, if anybody wants to reach out and be friends, and I like that stuff.
And are you at Julie B Creative on Instagram also? You own Julie B Creative, it seems like.
Yeah, Julie B Creative is kind of my username all across the board for all social media.
Yeah.
I wanted juliebeck.com, but that was already taken. But yeah, no, Julie B Creative. And that was also another way of kind of owning like who I am. So I'm creative and I'm an artist. So Julie B Creative is my space.
It also sounds like it's sort of a like an imperative. Like if you ever kind of get off, it's a, hey, Julie, be creative.
Be creative.
And just for people listening, it's Julie B, the letter, not B-E, even though, you know, yeah. I just made that joke. Okay.
Thank you so much also for doing this and putting the time and effort into this. It obviously, it brings us all together in a certain way that we can all relate to each other in so many ways.
Yeah. Thank you. This episode is sponsored by Gamblin Artist Colors. Have you ever wondered why cadmium and cobalt colors are so expensive? Are they worth laying out the cash every single time? And what's a modern color? How is it different from a mineral color? So I'm curious, what questions do you have about oil colors? I want to hear from you. Earlier this year, you came up with so many great questions for Gamblin. I'm handing the mic over to you again. From now until Sunday, January 7th, you can ask Gamblin Artist Colors founder Robert Gamblin and product manager Scott Gelatley your own questions about oil colors in another special episode. So go to savvypainter.com/Gamblin by Sunday, January 7th to submit your color questions. I can't wait to hear what you come up with. Congratulations again to Julie, and thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. Next up is our second place winner, Susie Zefting Kuhn. Susie is an artist from Rochester, New York, and our judge, Carol Marine, selected Susie's painting, I Have My Eye on You, for second prize. Susie received a generous gift from both Gamblin Artist Colors and Trakel Art Supplies and a cash prize. And Susie's here to tell us about her painting and her experience as the ringleader for a community of artists in Rochester, New York, who work out of the Hungerford Building, as well as the Main Street Artists, a group that Susie started realizing that, you know what, having a community of artists to work with really helps. Here's Susie Zeftin-Kuhn.
Susie, welcome to The Savvy Painter, and congratulations on winning second place.
Thanks, Antrese. It was so exciting.
Tell me a little bit about the work that you create, and what is it about the subject matter that fascinates you?
Well, I've always been a portrait artist at heart, so I mainly do portraits, and I moved into animals. I started going to zoos in whatever cities I was in, and I would kind of study them and watch them, and it was just really intriguing. So I started taking a lot of photographs. And it's funny because a lot of times when I do portraits of people, I'll do them in oils, but I'll always do portraits of animals in pastels.
Why is that?
Because I feel like when you use a pastel, you can get the texture of the fur.
Mm.
It's just a lot easier for me to achieve that.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, there's something fascinating about them. They have their own little souls.
So tell me a little bit about I Have My Eye on You, the painting that won second place.
My giraffe.
Yes.
Yeah, I was visiting my best friend out in Colorado. So we went to the Denver Zoo, mm-hmm. and their giraffe viewing areas are really cool. So this one caught my eye because it was kind of off by itself. And I even said to my friend, I said, I wonder what that giraffe did that he's in detention over there. So yeah, he or she was all by herself, and there was that brick wall behind it, and just the juxtaposition of the triangular shapes on the giraffe and the squares and rectangles on the wall, it just caught my eye right away. I was able to get a few good shots, and I decided to try to paint that.
What were some of the challenges in painting that?
Well, the challenges were getting all the shapes right, number one, and getting the values right. But after a while, I was just having a lot of fun with it. Once I kind of got everything in its place,
mm-hmm.
then it just kind of breezed along.
Yeah, then it's really fun. When we were chatting earlier, we were talking about communities of artists, how important mm-hmm. it is for artists to be a part of a community. And you mentioned you're sort of a ringleader there in Rochester.
Yeah, they all tell me I'm the ringleader. I'm very much a believer in having community. I'm part of a building here in Rochester called the Hungerford, and there's lots of artist studios. So we have our own little community here. We all support each other. We all promote each other. You can walk out of your studio, walk into somebody else's and start chatting about what they're doing or what you're doing. I carried that further in my studio space. I started a group called the Main Street Artists. So I now have 17 members in my studio spaces. So it's the same thing. It's some of us are here working, and they can get stumped and they'll say, take a look at this. You know, what do you think? So we all help each other. And then I'm also president of the Rochester Art Club, which is the second oldest art organization in the country. And I got all the other art club presidents together, and we started a council so that we can help each other as different organizations.
Oh, nice. So what are some of the ways that you've been able to sort of help artists by starting that coalition or that, you know, by kind of bonding together and making the group more expansive?
Well, there's a great sharing of ideas. You know, we all exhibit our work and show our work. We help each other, promote each other. And it's just, you're a part of something.
Yeah.
You're a part of like-minded people.
Yeah, which is, it's so helpful. It's just so important to, when you're working as hard as we do as artists, to have that camaraderie and know that you're not alone and that there's somebody else right next to you who's working just as hard as you are. And so you're not the crazy person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you have any advice for artists who are thinking about submitting work to a competition? What are some of the things that you look for when thinking about entering one?
Well, I've entered national shows a lot. And I guess when I first started, I don't know, it's like a leap of faith, really. So you have to be prepared for rejection, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more that you enter, if you can get past that step, maybe it's a good idea to look at their past exhibitions to see the type of work that was admitted
mm-hmm.
and what types of work got awards. That might help give somebody the confidence to perhaps enter that particular show. Start off with a regional exhibition, you know, and see how that goes. And then you can progress to a national exhibition in your media.
Do you look at the judges?
Sometimes I do. I used to do that more in the beginning, but then I've gotten to the point where I stopped worrying about what the judge did, because I just put, I guess I try to have faith that the particular juror can have an open mind
mm-hmm.
so that they're not necessarily looking for work that is just like what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a tendency not to pay too much attention to the judge.
Interesting.
It's not my barometer for whether I enter a show or not.
Gotcha. I'd love it if it's a big topic. So I think this will be helpful for other artists, regardless of whether or not it's about competition. But one thing that I think is really, it takes time is to develop that skin. So can you talk about, you know, so you got second place in this competition that we just had, which is fantastic. But some of the other ones
right.
where it didn't quite work out, are there ways that you deal with the disappointment of it? Or did you just learn to deal with that?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, sure, you're disappointed if you don't get in a show. But I tried not to spend too much time on it. And I learned pretty early. I had an experience where I had entered a painting in a local art club show. It did not get an award, but at the time it did not get an award and it was critiqued. I also had heard that the national show I had entered the same piece into had been accepted. So different jurors, different days, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with the Rochester Art Club, we have several shows a year that are juried. So we're bringing in jurors and I get to sit in on their process.
Mm-hmm. You get the behind.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have had many of them say to me that, okay, this is the way I would judge the show today, but tomorrow I might judge it entirely different. I mean, it's human nature. Your mm-hmm. mood is going to come into play. You know, I guess because I've had the luxury of seeing the back end of it, I guess it makes me more understanding of what these jurors sometimes go through. I mean, they're looking at hundreds, thousands of entries. It's got to be something that's going to catch their eye.
I think that that piece of it is just so important that you kind of understand I'm maybe entering this competition because I want X, Y, and Z. I have a specific reason that I want to do this maybe. But I also know that if I'm not selected, it's not personal. Or if I don't get the award, right. it's not personal. It's just that juror is thinking is attracted to this type of work and not that type of work or whatever it may be.
Exactly.
I've seen that happen often where somebody enters a piece into a show and it gets rejected from one. And then the next time they enter the same piece, sometimes to the same organization, and it gets selected and may even win.
Exactly.
When you think of it that way, it helps to kind of pull back from that personalization of it.
Right.
Very good. Okay. So this one last question. I love asking this question because I love hearing about people's habits and rituals. Do you have any habits? I know it's kind of silly, but I just, it's so fun. Habits are...
I spend too much time on my computer.
Well, what do you do on your computer then, Susie?
Usually, yeah, I get caught up on Facebook like everybody else.
Yeah.
But what I get caught up with is the artwork.
Yeah.
It's like, because I'm connected with so many other artists, it's like I just scan through all the other stuff and I just zoom in on the artwork.
It's inspiring.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very inspiring.
What do you do when you get into your studio and you're ready to get down to business, when you're ready to get down to pick up the brushes or pick up the pastel? Do you have any habits or rituals that you kind of start your studio time with?
I usually have music playing on Pandora on my iPad while I paint. Sometimes I'm here in the studio by myself. Sometimes I'm not. Sometimes my studio mates are here. It's just usually it's a matter of dragging myself away from the computer, getting myself to the easel, and getting to work. That's what it takes.
It does. And I love that because it's not about waiting for the art fairy to come down and sprinkle art dust on you or anything like that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, Susie, congratulations again. And thank you so much for taking time out of your studio to talk with me and to share your experiences with the rest of the listeners.
Great. Thanks so much, Antrese. It was nice speaking with you, too.
Congratulations again to Susie, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Next up is our third place winner, Randall David Tipton, and Randall's here to talk about his painting, Cascade Headspring. He has an interesting process, and he also shares with us his strategy for entering competitions. So here is Randall David Tipton. Randall, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter podcast, and congratulations on winning third prize in the Savvy Art Competition.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
So you paint, your work to me looks like you kind of go back and forth between more representational and what to my eye looks like full on abstract. Can you talk a little bit about what you choose to paint and what it is that fascinates you about those two types of representation?
Sure. It isn't as conscious as you would think. And the subject matter determines the degree of abstraction. Now, I realize they can look quite different, and I think that's kind of a weak link in my portfolio, but that is truly how it happens. I go for walks, I come home, I'm inspired, I've had my iPhone, I've taken some pictures, and I just start painting. And sometimes, if it's simple, it'll be more abstract. If it needs more detail, I'll do that. So there's not an ideology behind it.
When I went to look at your work, though, I just kept going back and forth between the two because it's just so interesting to me, the thought process that goes into it. So do you get most of your inspiration from taking walks?
Yeah, and locally. I live just a bit south of Portland, and there's lots of forests and wetlands around me, and they're generally my subject matter.
Can you talk a little bit about your process of how you work? Because I noticed you use different types of medium.
Yeah, for both. Sometimes there'll be an undercoat just to get it not white. And then with either watercolor or oils, I'll start putting random paint on the surface. And if it's oil paint, I might try to block in some of the forms early on. But then when I need something specific, I'll do the same thing with kind of blobs of paint. I'll squeegee it out, and then I can start carving into it with tools, constructing it one way or another until it looks like what I'm trying to depict. It's not like I know how to do it to begin with.
So your painting process is more of a discovery.
Yeah, real trial and error. Lots of air. But it's okay. I mean, it's more fun that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's exciting.
Yeah. I used to do watercolor in the way I was taught early on, which, you know, you use the white of the paper for light values and all that nonsense. There's no joy in it for me. That's my bottom line. I have to enjoy the process or I don't want to do it.
So you paint watercolors and then you paint oil on top of that?
Well, if it's the real disaster, yeah, I will do that. I'll put it like a varnish over it and think, okay, you know, I failed with watercolor, acrylic, and now I'm going to go over to the other side of my studio and do oil painting.
On the same painting, though, yes?
Yeah, but it has a layer of acrylic varnish in between.
Uh-huh.
And generally, my surface is Yupo, which is plastic. It'll last for a million years, right?
Uh-huh.
So I'm not real worried about archival issues.
So Yupo, I might know people who paint on Yupo and just not be aware of it, but tell me what that is.
Well, it's a Japanese, they call it a paper, but it's just a sheet of plastic. It was developed for printing signage, and somebody tried watercolors on it, and it just takes it beautifully. The way I would describe it, yeah, a lot of people will have like a butcher tray to mix their watercolors in, and mm-hmm. the tray itself always has such beautiful things happening into it. That's what it's like to paint on Yupo. It just takes the paint and does gorgeous things. Now, it's also very hard to control, so for me, it means a lot of manipulation, lifting the paper, turning it, hair drying it, blotting a lot. I mean, I really get physical with it. Mm-hmm. But you can get some very beautiful work. And because the sheet is so white itself, all the colors, even if there's some opaque colors, will have light shine through them. And so they're very radiant.
Interesting. I'm going to have to play with Yupo now. I like it.
Yeah, you'll like it. And you can do straight oil painting on Yupo. You don't have to do the failure part. You can just, it doesn't have any tooth. So it's kind of like painting on a piece of glass. Have you ever done that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know how it slides everywhere?
Yes. Yeah.
You just have to put it on thick enough. You can glaze later, but that first layer should be thick enough to stick.
Interesting. And then so that first layer, do you have to let that dry before you go back in and work on it then? Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. Okay. Yeah, but I've got a really good system for that. I'm using an alkyd white and then also liquin. That's a painting medium. Mm-hmm. And together, I almost have a dry surface the next day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's really important to my process. I don't want to wait for paint to dry. I can't stand that. I work fast, you know, and I don't want my materials to fight me. You know, it's hard enough.
Right. Right. So tell me a little bit about the piece that you submitted to the Savvy Art Competition. What inspired that piece?
Okay. That's a bit of a long story, but I'll try to be brief. I was a resident at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology on the Oregon coast. I had also been there in 2010, the first time, and I was trying to do a narrative landscape. So my idea was these really long paintings that you couldn't see the whole thing at any one time. You'd have to kind of unroll it like a Chinese scroll.
Mm.
They didn't work out. So when they let me come back in 2014, I thought, okay, I am going to get at least one of them right. So, I mean, within an hour of arriving, I was working on the piece that won. And it was an abstract response to this beautiful surrounding of Cascade Head, where the center is located.
Mm.
And so those were just impressions, really. I was really fired up to do it.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to other artists who are just thinking about entering a competition?
The first thing I would say is like the judges' work. If you like their work, your chances are much better that they will like yours. I would never, ever enter anything where I didn't respect and appreciate the jurors' work. Absolutely. I mean, it's just too much trouble shipping things off. And
when you were talking earlier, you had some really great advice that I had actually never even thought of, but it's so brilliant and simple about some of the ways that you choose to enter a competition. So specifically an online competition, for example, what advantages does that give you?
Well, when I saw the announcement for it, I just thought for a minute and realized I have some really large things I could enter. I mean, I wasn't going to have to send it anywhere. So anything I could enter. I mean, I kept reading the instructions going, there's got to be a catch here. But there wasn't, you know, you didn't need it to be recent work. Any dimension was okay. So I entered two long paintings and thought, wow, this is great.
That was Carol Marine, by the way. She wanted, because I said, well, should we do a theme? Should we do this? And she's like, nope, no themes, no restrictions. I want it completely open. I said, okay, you're the judge.
Yeah, yeah.
One last question for you. Do mm-hmm. you have any sort of habits that you feel like contribute to your growth as an artist?
One that I can think of, I look at Pinterest. I'm a self-taught artist. I don't have any advanced degrees or anything. Consequently, I missed a whole lot of art history that I'm now discovering on Pinterest. And I swear to God, I can spend an hour with that and get more education just because a pin of an image will lead to some research and I'll find this, you know, totally unknown artist to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rich. I look at it all the time. And another habit I do that's very helpful, I take a picture of what I'm working on with my iPhone and then go upstairs. My studio is in a basement. I go upstairs, and as I'm brushing my teeth, getting ready for bed, I'll have the phone out there and I'll be looking at it. And somehow that size really helps me with composition and color. And it's been a really great little trick.
Beautiful. Well, Randall David Tipton, thank you so much for submitting your work and for sharing these little tidbits with us.
Well, thank you, Andrews. This was fun.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you again to Carol Marine for judging the competition. She had a lot on her plate and some tough choices to make, and I'm really impressed by the quality of submissions and, frankly, a little relieved that I did not have to make those tough choices. That was all up to Carol. So, Carol, thank you so, so much. And again, a big congratulations to Julie Beck, Susie Zeftin-Kuhn, and Randall David Tipton, as well as our honorable mentions, Hannah Mogbul, Christian Fagerland, and Brian DiNicola. If you want to see all the work that we just talked about, just go to savvypainter.com, click on the podcast tab, and you'll find the show notes there. You'll see paintings by Julie in the show notes for this episode, as well as all of the artists that we mentioned in our conversation. You'll also get to see Randall David Tipton, Susan Zeftin-Kuhn, and the honorable mentions. All of that can be found at savvypainter.com. Just click on the podcast link. Until next week, this is Anne Treeswood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thanks so much for listening.